So tonight's Dharma talk is called Crossing the Flood. This is a classic image in the Buddhist teachings. There's many places where he uses the image of having to cross over to the other side and how to that's causes potentially some problems. And I want to start just by reading something called the Simile of the Raft, which is part of a longer sutta, but I'm going to read just this section. And then the rest of the talk, I'm basically going to talk about this interesting extended simile. Bhikkhus, I shall show you how the Dhamma is similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping. Listen and attend closely to what I shall say. Yes, venerable sir, the bhikkhus replied. The Blessed One said this: Bhikkhus, suppose a man in the course of a journey saw a great expanse of water whose near shore was dangerous and fearful and whose further shore was safe and free from fear, but there was no ferry boat or bridge for going to the far shore. Then he thought, this is a great expanse of water, whose near shore is dangerous and fearful, and whose further shore is safe and free from fear. But there is no ferry boat or bridge for going to the far shore. Suppose I collect grass, twigs, branches, and leaves, and bind them together into a raft, and supported by the raft, and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. And then the man collected grass, twigs, branches, and leaves, and bound them together into a raft, and supported by the raft, and making an effort with his hands and feet, he got safely across to the far shore. Then, when he had got across and had arrived at the far shore, he might think thus: this raft has been very helpful to me, since supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to hoist it on my head or load it on my shoulder and then go wherever I want. Now, bhikkhus, what do you think? By doing so, would the man be doing what he shouldn't have be done with the raft? No, venerable sir, replied the bhikkhus. By doing what would the man be doing what should be done with the raft? Here, bhikkhus, when the man got across and arrived at the far shore, he might think thus: this raft has been very helpful to me, since supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to haul it onto the dry land or to set it adrift in the water and then go wherever I want. Now, because it is by so doing that the man would be doing what should be done with that raft. So I have shown you how the Dhamma is similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, but not for the purpose of grasping. So that's the classic simile. And let's just sort of take this apart bit by bit. The first thing he says is that this guy, someone's on a journey, which is the classic image of being on the path, on the path of the Dhamma, right? Or on a journey. And he came to this vast body of water. In other places, this is called the flood, by the way. And the shore that he's on, the near shore, the shore he's on is dangerous. And so it's like, oh, I don't want to stay here, because you can see that the other side, the other shore is not dangerous. So the first question is, why is it dangerous? Why is this shore that we're on now, which is what this simile is talking about, why is it that we think of it as dangerous? And we have to sort of separate between the actual physical image of a shore and what the simile is implying here. It isn't the world itself that is dangerous, though it's getting more so these days. It's our habitual reactive patterns of mind, our tendencies toward greed, aversion, and delusion. The safe shore is the place where we have learned equanimity, where we've learned not to be reactive. Right understanding, the first step on the Eightfold Path, is what I'm talking about here. We can see where I am now isn't working. There is a place I can go to that's safe. That's right understanding. So what arises in our external world and in our internal world can be overwhelming. The flood, the continuous flow of thoughts, of being caught in memories from the past and thoughts of the future. And the flood is often broken down into various different categories, I suppose. The first is the flood of sensuality, sense experience that we label pleasant or unpleasant. We go after or more or try to avoid. This is the first light that we're flooded by sensory input all the time. It's like 20 sense impressions a second, right? So I want to read something here by Ajahn Susito, where he is basically talking about this issue of the flood of sensuality. This is the flood of sensuality, a torrent under whose trance sense objects seem to offer pleasant sights, sounds, tastes, fragrances, and touches. With some experience and considered attention, we can note that none of these, once seen, heard, etc., actually induce the kind of feeling that the current promises in any but the most fleeting way. In the gentle or pulsing waves of this flood, however, the objects of the senses seem irresistible, charming, and productive of real satisfaction. It happens all day long, and with luck it's mostly okay. Sometimes it's pleasant for a short while, and sometimes it's unpleasant. But the pleasant, once established, gets to be normal, and then boring, so desire for new sources of pleasure kick in. However, we can't really have any of it because it runs through consciousness like water through our fists. Sensory input, with its pleasure and displeasure, passes. That's it. So the nature of sensory pleasure, as pleasant as it can be, and we can't deny that it can seem quite pleasant, just is something that's there and then it's gone, which is the nature of everything. So the second layer of this flood, and these layers get more subtle, is called the flood of becoming. The ideas that center around time and identity, thoughts of the past and future, are all happening right now. So I'm thinking about the past, but that's right now that I'm doing that thinking. Or I'm planning for the future, but that's right now. So it seems like we go into the past and into the future, but we never go anywhere other than right this present moment. And the issue is that we start to strongly identify with these ideas of what happened in the past and thoughts about what we might do in the future. And this causes us to be caught, in a sense. So it's another note from Ajahn Susito here. And yet there's a current in the mind that creates a felt identity who was, is, and will be. So we get this identity of who we were in the past, who we are now, and who we are going to be in the future. Nostalgia and regret of what I was. A conceit may form, having been this, surely I deserve to become that. Or its negative form, I've never been this, so I'll never become one of those. There's a lot of drama and suffering and stress in this flood. so much that we fail to question, who is this character? The spell of the flood of becoming doesn't work in the present. That is why we study it, because through investigation we come out of it. So now he's talking about the importance of mindfulness, because mindfulness is really a study of this flood of stories about the past or ideas about the future. Then, the third is the flood of views, an extension of the flood of becoming. So these are deep-rooted ideas of who we are and how things are. This is where a lot of our problems in life arise, or are what we think of as problems, I should be careful to say. It's like we have this idea that this is how things should be. I know the correct way. I know how to do this, how to be. I know I'm right and they're wrong. There's that part. Or I know they're right and I'm wrong. Equally problematic. And we sort of identify with these views of you know, how things should be. And these are like cultural views. These are things about how we were brought up. You know, our upbringing creates a whole set of views of like, well, that's the way everybody gets brought up, right? I mean, everybody grows up the same way. Well, of course, that's not true at all. I mean, people grow up in all kinds of different ways. But we start to believe that our way is the right way and everybody else's way is the wrong way or the wrong ways. And this is another layer of this mental flood that overwhelms us, right? And finally, the flood, what's called the flood of ignorance, of not seeing things as they really are, that they're impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not self, that there is no permanent self in all of this story making about who's right and who's wrong and who I am and who I'm going to be and who I was and how important all of these sense experiences are. These are just ideas. They have no concrete reality because they all are impermanent. They're all changing all the time. None of them, they're called unsatisfactory because in the end, none of them work as a way to make us really happy. And the most subtle of these ignorance is that we don't see that all of these ideas we have, we create this sense of self, of a separate solid self around these ideas. I'm like this and like that. I am this way. I am that way. I think this. I believe that. These are all ways of creating identity when there's no one there to be. This flood, this last one, this is like an underground current that runs underneath the other three, the flood of sensuality, the flood of becoming, and the flood of views. It's all of those three are the outer manifestations of this underground current, the flood of ignorance, which is a broad category of everything, really. So what's the problem here? If we can see the flood, if we have right understanding, and we see, yep, sure enough, this isn't working the way it is now. And we can see that we got to get across to the other shore. And we know that there's some way of doing this. In our case, you know, in the teachings of the Buddha, right? But somehow or other, we get caught into this space of, I'm not ready yet. That I need to be better. That I have to have more time. I don't have enough time to do all this and do everything else I have to do in this life. So somehow we get caught in all these this excuse making of not go, even trying to go across the flood. And so this is where right intention, the second step on the Noble Eightfold Path, arises. Because we have to form the intention, yep, I'm going to go across that flood. I'm going to do this. This is like you form that firm intention. Because I can see that that's what I need to do. I need to go across the flood. But then we form that intention, and then sure enough, we notice, oh, here we are on the edge of this huge body of water. And to get to the other side, there's no bridge and there's no ferry. There's no way of, nothing's going to help us to get across. We have to really do it on our own. We have to make that choice and then decide, all right, now I actually have to do it, and however I can. And so then he says this really interesting thing. He says, suppose I collect grass, twigs, branches, and leaves and bind them together into a raft. Doesn't sound like a very good raft. Just a bunch of twigs and leaves all tied together somehow. But what the Buddha is pointing to here is just take what's right there in front of you. You don't need anything else. You know, we can get caught in the, okay, I'm gonna go across, I'm gonna get a raft, but first I gotta go and find some really big trees and cut them just to the right size to make this big log raft, and then build a little hut on the raft to keep all my stuff in it, and a mast and a sail. And we get so caught up in all the stuff we have to do to even before we can even get going, that we never go anywhere. Because we think this is this, we make it into this enormous project. When really all we need to do is take what's all around us right now. We have right now everything we need to cross the flood. We just have to go ahead and make this raft out of twigs and grass and stuff. And go. But of course, this raft, you know, it's not, it's just, I mean, the way the Buddha describes it, he sort of lays on this raft, and with his arms and his legs and legs, he sort of paddles and kicks his way across. Doesn't sound that pleasant. In fact, it's pretty much guaranteed you're going to get wet. It's going to be unpleasant at times. I mean, it might be, you know, sometimes the water's kind of warm, the sun's shining on your back, but after a while, or even right away, it's going to be like, ooh, I have to get wet to do this. I can't sort of stay dry in this big comfy raft and sort of just float across. It's that image is quite distinct. It's like I have to get down and get in the water and get wet. We can't avoid the flood. You know, so that flood of thoughts and emotions and images and plans and remembrances, we can't avoid it. We can't just say, okay, I'm going to cross the flood, but I'm going to sort of somehow magically just leap across and ignore the flood. Instead, we got to get right down in it. And this is pointed out in a couple of rather interesting readings I want to do here. One of these is a poem. This is by Dana Falls in her book Going and In. It's called Awakening. Awakening, can I stand the radiance? When the goddess gazes from my eyes, when my heart opens wide, when the current of life sweeps me far from safety, when even the illusion of control is lost, and what's left to me is love. Can I breathe a prayer of gratitude and praise? Unlike the winter groundhog, can I raise my face to the sun and not run from the shadow that, embodied, I will always cast in daylight? So when we go into that flood, we're going to see stuff that we don't like at all. That shadow, what's called the shadow side, is going to become quite obvious. And we have to be okay with that. We can't, oh, well, no, I only want to swim where it's nice. I got no rocks, no rapids, please. I'm just going to, you know, I want it to be smooth and calm the whole time I'm going across. Well, that's not going to happen either. Yeah. And this is another famous Dhamma book I want to read from. This is called The Velveteen Rabbit. Really, truly a great Dhamma book, actually. What is real? Asked a rabbit one day when we were lying side by side near the nursery fender before Nana came to tidy the room. Does it mean having things that buzz inside you and a stick-out handle? Real isn't how you are made, said the skin horse. It's a thing that happens to you. When a child loves you for a long time, a long, long time, not just to play with, but really loves you, then you become real. Does it hurt? Asked the rabbit. Sometimes, said the skin horse, for he was always truthful, but when you are real, you don't mind being hurt. Does it happen all at once, like being wound up? He asked, or bit by bit? It doesn't happen all at once, said the skin horse. You become. It takes a long time. That's why it doesn't often happen to people who break easily or have sharp edges or who have to be carefully kept. Generally, by the time you are real, most of your hair has been loved off and your eyes drop out and you get loose in the joints and very shabby. But those things don't matter at all, because once you are real, you can't be ugly, except to people who don't understand. I suppose you were real, said the rabbit. And then he wished he had not said it, for he thought the skin horse might be sensitive. But the skin horse only smiled. The boy's uncle made me real, he said. That was a great many years ago. But once you are real, you can't become unreal again. It always lasts forever. The rabbit sighed. He thought it would be a long time before this magic called real happened to him. He longed to become real, to know what it felt like, and yet the idea of growing shabby and losing his eyes and whiskers was rather sad. He wished that he could become it without these uncomfortable things happening to him. This is a great Dharma image of crossing the flood. Not wanting to get wet. So what does it mean to get wet? It means we have to directly experience the contents of our mind. We have to accept that shadow side, the dark side. We can't sail over our thoughts. We have to get right down in the flood and use our arms and legs to paddle across, as scary as that might seem. It's just, that's the nature of the practice, that it's going to sometimes be unpleasant and scary, and we can't pretend otherwise. We have to get down and dirty, so to speak. So the idea of that, though, is like, oh, I really don't want to do that. But here's an interesting piece of information. This is from the Samyutta Nikaya, and this is actually the very first sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya talking about this issue. Thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling at Savatthi in Jetta's grove. Then, when the night had advanced, a certain deva of stunning beauty, illuminating the entire Jetta's grove, approached the Blessed One. Having approached, he paid homage to the Blessed One, stood to one side, and said to him, "How, dear sir, did you cross the flood?" "By not halting, friend, and by not straining, I crossed the flood." "But how is it, dear sir, that by not halting and by not straining, you crossed the flood?" "When I came to a standstill, friend, then I sank. But when I struggled, then I got swept away. It is in this way, friend, that by not halting and by not straining, I crossed the flood." Not straining and not halting. So it's like, what the Buddha is saying here is we need to have this balanced approach. This is right action and skillful effort. Steps on the Eightfold Path. Why is this so important? Well, if we strain, if we try too hard, we make the practice some sort of grim duty. And we're swept away because we become exhausted and discouraged. When we strain, we get even wetter. We splash. We become overwhelmed. And our thoughts and emotions like just flood. It's too much. If we halt, we sink. We get swallowed up by the constant stream of thoughts and emotions. We lose the strength of practice that we have gained. We have to start all over again. But hopefully we've learned something along the way. This is why daily practice is so strongly emphasized and why continuity of practice is emphasized on retreat. Often we start to think when we sink, we've thought, "I'm doing just fine as I am. I stop putting effort into the practice. Doing just fine as I am." It's always we need more than that. Another way of looking at this image is we halt because we cling to the pleasant in our practice, and we strain when we are averse to the unpleasant that is arising in our practice. Either case, we get distracted. What's interesting, however, is that often what stops us from going into the flood is fear of failure, of, there's no way I can possibly do that. I'm not even willing to make the attempt. But here's the interesting thing in this verse I just read. The Buddha sank and the Buddha got swept away. You know, we need to understand that we will fail. That it's okay to fail. That we just start again. That's the nature of the practice. We just start again, and we start again, and we start again. Okay, new raft, let's get out into that flood again. This is just the nature of the practice. This is a little poem from a book called First Buddhist Women. And it's an enlightenment poem. And the tradition was amongst the bhikkhunis, so when they became enlightened, they would write this little poem. And this poem sort of described how they got to be an enlightened being. "Four or five times I left my cell. I had no peace of mind, no control over my mind. I went to a nun I thought I could trust. She taught me the Dharma, the elements of body and mind, the nature of perception, of earth, water, fire, and wind. I heard what she said and sat cross-legged, 7 days full of joy. When on the eighth I stretched out my feet, the great dark was torn apart. So the thing here's this, here we have this again. 4 or 5 times I left my cell. So she kept trying and failing and trying and failing, but she kept going back. And then she went and found someone who could teach her that little bit more she needed to know, who she someone she trusted. And things went on from there. She became an enlightened being. That's the nature of the practice. Then there's this really interesting section in the sutta where now he's got across to the other shore. And then he instead of carrying the raft around with him, he just leaves it on the shore, lets it float away in the current. Well, what's this all about? This is the idea that even the Dhamma, even the practice, is just something that's a useful tool, a skillful means, and at some point we're done with it. And if we cling to it, oh no, I got to cling to this practice, and now we're just grasping to a much more subtle thing, but we're still grasping, we're still clinging to something. So at a certain point, when we get to the other shore, we let go of even the practice. It's the last thing we have to let go of, because it's got us all the way across, but then we have to let it go. Strange thought when you think about it. But the Dhamma is just skillful means. It's just something temporary. Of course, the problem is, well, how do I know when it's time to let go of the raft? How do I know I'm really solidly on the other shore? This is not an easy question to answer. There is, the Buddha talks about it in a number of ways. And there's one here I want to talk about. This is once again, something from the Samyutta Nikaya, and it's another image the Buddha uses. When, because a carpenter or a carpenter's apprentice looks at the handle of his adze, he sees the impressions of his fingers and his thumb, but he does not know so much of the adze handle has been worn away today, so much yesterday, so much earlier. But when it has worn away, the knowledge occurs to him that it has worn away. So what the Buddha is implying here is, we'll know. It's a gradual process. You think of your hands using an axe handle, it will take quite a while to wear through an axe handle in regular, steady use. But at some point, it would wear away. Some point, we will be enlightened. It just happens. It's not something we can control. It's just something that happens through the practice and through deepening our practice. It's imperceptible. It's like we think, oh, well, I just sat today and nothing happened, right? But actually, you're planting that seed. Every time you sit, you're planting that seed to wear that handle of that adze down a little bit more over time. And it just works that way. It's happening right now. We're wearing down our axe handles as we sit here and share the Dhamma. It's what's happening right now. So we have to just decide, all right, I'm going to get wet. We have to take that resolve to get wet. It's worth it to get in there and splash around in that flood. And it's the only way to get across to the other side. There's no other way. There's no magic. So I'd like to finish with this other poem by Dana Faulds here. This is called Life Here at the Edge. When love lights a fire in the heart, don't be so quick to quell the flames. To be fully alive is to welcome the beloved in countless names and guises, not turn away the wild with the tame. Drink your fill of longing. Let love wash through in waves that lift you up and carry both your daring and your fear straight to unknown places. Yes, there is danger in not staying safely cloaked in morality and labels, but there's life here on the edge, and a choice to be made between thoughtful abandon and passionate restraint. The plaintive cry of the heart can be ignored only at the price of a fully realized life. Throw arms wide to possibilities that move and call you to come forth in freedom and in fullness. Trust the need, the seed of grace within to blossom without sin or sorrow, for you are surely big enough to hold the truth as it unfolds. So let's just dedicate the merit of the practice. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.